Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast. I'm Neil Lawson, your host and director of Compass. Joining me to help manage the questions is Grace Barnett from the Compass office. Hello, Grace. You well?
Hello, I'm well, thanks.
Good, good. Look, these are unprecedented times and we need to rise to the new and enormous challenges we now face. Over the next few weeks and maybe months, let's see, we'll be speaking with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists and public service workers about how we come out of all of this in much better shape than we went in, a good society after COVID-19. These conversations have live access for Compass members who can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to participate in a live call, go to compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back and enjoy this week four. If this crisis reveals anything, it's the structural depths of inequality that scars our country and the lives of millions of people. Yes, COVID-19 impacts on everyone, but it impacts them differently. Joining us this week to discuss inequality in the era of the coronavirus is Ruth Lister. Ruth has spent her life researching poverty and campaigning against it. She worked at and then directed the Child Poverty Action Group before becoming an academic, principally at Loughborough University as Professor of Social Policy. She has published many books on poverty, citizenship and feminism, but has remained politically active, serving on the influential Labour Social Justice Commission in the early 1990s, and has been involved in Compass from the word go, joining the management committee and then chairing the organisation for much of its life. She's also a member of the House of Lords. The format will be that I will ask Ruth a few questions and then open it up to Compass members on the call for questions and comments before we finish no later than 7 p.m. Please keep any questions and comments brief so we can get as many in as possible. As Zoom etiquette demands, please keep yourself on mute unless invited to speak, and please post your questions in the chat box, which you'll find on the bar at the bottom of the screen to the right of the mute button. If you want to tweet on this, the hashtag is It's Complicated. And finally, please note that this session is being recorded and will go out as a podcast. So, Ruth, it's great to have you on the call tonight. Let's start with where you are and how you are.
Okay, well, hello. I'm in Nottingham, my home. I'm feeling okay. I hope all of you listening in are feeling okay as well. I mean, inevitably there are times, I think, when we all feel anxious and sometimes feel bloody angry with the government for its kind of sheer incompetence and arrogance and the fact that people are dying unnecessarily because of that. But I'm also acutely aware, I think probably more than I've ever been, of my own privilege. So, I mean, as you were saying in the introduction, they say it that we're all in it together. Well, we're not. And yes, as you said, the virus is indiscriminate other than by age, but it's not falling on and the sort of constellation of inequalities, be it social class, gender, race, disability, the impact, both the health and the socioeconomic impact, which are intertwined, is differential. And people are hurting and hurting really badly, and reading of people going hungry, fearful of losing their homes. And the everyday effect of it, I mean, I said I'm sort of conscious of my own privilege. You know, I mean, here in a nice house, I've got a balcony, I can look out, I can walk by the river, and there are people who are so crammed up in their homes, overcrowded, women who are being subjected to domestic violence, people with kids who haven't got a garden to take them into, who are, where they're overcrowded, they're even more vulnerable. I mean, you can't socially isolate in overcrowded accommodation. People who can't afford to stop working or who've been thrown out of their jobs, don't have the luxury of living at home, of working at home, all that is going on. So that's the kind of thing, one way in which those inequalities are playing out and are being revealed And the other, I think the big thing, as we talked a bit about last week, was the unequal structure of rewards that care workers in particular, but also all those other people who are now, who paid completely disregarded in the past, and indeed as those who are immigrants won't be allowed into the country under the new immigration rules, this is all being exposed and being discussed, thank goodness.
Thanks Ruth. You were just kind of, the internet connection was just losing a bit for me at the end. Yeah. So how do you, so you feel that, and it's kind of like, do you think we're having a national conversation about that stuff yet? Do you think that's beginning to happen? Because I mean, I watched, for instance, the brilliant little John Harris video of him talking to people in crowded homes and people that, you know, that don't have secure incomes. Do you think there's a kind of national conversation yet about the levels of inequality? Do you think it's kind of, this is going to make a breakthrough?
I think it is beginning. Certainly the conversation around the value of care work, I mean, you'd have to be blind not to see what you know, the disparity between how we've treated so-called workers who are seen as key workers. So that conversation is certainly having. And I think gradually, I mean, it's not known enough yet exactly how people in poverty, people in poor housing are being affected. But politicians being asked about, you know, it's all very well the lockdown, but what effect is having on people who don't have gardens and so forth? So I think it's beginning to happen. And I think it's, you know, it's up to us to make it happen more and to put in more information into that conversation.
And what would you like to see happen? You know, whether that's policy-wise, you know, in terms of anti-poverty policies or more broadly, you know, what are the kind of suite of things that you think we should be looking at coming out of this? Some of these issues?
In the short term, we've got to do something about the poverty that people are experiencing, even more acute than in normal times. And don't let's forget that there is considerable poverty in normal times. And although, you know, the increase in universal credit was very welcome, it's not nearly enough. So there's nothing has been announced for children at all. So civil society groups are calling for an increase in child benefit of at least £10, and that has to be a minimum demand, I think. Increases in what are called legacy benefits, i.e. those people who haven't yet got onto university. We need to do suspend the benefit cap, because that actually means that many people getting the universal credit increase actually aren't benefiting from it because the cap hits them, and suspending the two-child limit. And those were things which would help particularly women, would help members of Black and minority ethnic communities. But then we also need to start a conversation now about longer term or medium to longer term changes in the structure of rewards, Social Security.
Okay, and then one issue that's cut on the agenda and that you've, I know, warmed to over the years is basic income, from the Financial Times to the Pope. People are now really interested in the concept. What are your thoughts on the role of basic income? And what if any reservations do you still have about it, Ruth?
Well, I think I've warmed more towards basic income primarily because of growing economic insecurity. Well, insecurity of all kinds, but primarily economic insecurity. And that has convinced me that there is a role for at least a partial basic income. And of course, that is writ large now in the current crisis, because the holes in the safety net are just, it's just like a bloody sieve. As you say, that, I mean, there's a parliamentary group which in fact is drawing up a statement just now on an emergency basic income for kind of during the recovery, whenever that comes, because it's too late probably now for the actual immediate emergency. But it is extraordinary the people who are getting behind the idea of a basic income, who would have laughed it out of court just a few weeks ago, really, or a few months ago. And I think, I mean, the other reason why I think I'm kind of more sympathetic towards it than I was, is that the kind of the people who are really promoting basic income now can't go the, it's not a kind of one that you, you know, bring in new BI, do away with the existing benefit system, and there, you know, everything's wonderful. And so I think there is a consensus now around we have to start with a partial one, which acts as a floor, secure floor underneath the rest of the system. And then we see, and we can build on that if need be. But that's as far as I would go for now, I think, while still having the debate about longer term basic income. But I know there were worries, you know, I know disabled groups are worried about, you know, disability benefits, and people worried about what happens with housing costs, things like that. So those are all things that need to be thought through and worked out for the longer term.
Okay, well, we'll look out for the work that the MPs are doing, which I know the Compass Basic Income Hub has been helping to coordinate. So look forward to the outcome of that. Let's broaden the conversation out a bit more now, because I mean, clearly there are policies we'd like to see, but you also think and write and talk about kind of some of the democratic architecture you need, we're going to need to ensure that all voices are heard. I mean, tell us a bit about the intersection between democracy and equality and anti-poverty strategies as you see it, Ruth.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, going back to my sort of more academic work, which has partly been around citizenship, particularly feminist approaches to citizenship, and partly around poverty. And I think one of the things that ties them together is the importance of social and economic rights as part of citizenship and part of human rights. But also a kind of theme that ran through both those strands of my work has been the kind of importance of agency and voice. And those all kind of point to a more participatory form of democracy, but one that ensures that the most marginalized voices are heard within it. Because I think quite often, or even the best meaning approaches to participatory democracy forget that the most marginalized voices, you can't just expect them to come to you. You've got to change the way you do things in order to involve them. And that was really brought home to me. I was involved, maybe 20 years ago now, in something called the Commission on Participation and Power, Poverty, Participation and Power, which had both equal numbers of people with experience of poverty and people like myself. And it just, I learned so much from that experience. And it made me understand that poverty is not just about money, although clearly that is absolutely crucial, but it's also about how people are treated, as social relations, it's a kind of relational psychosocial phenomenon. And that many, you know, some poverty activists, people like, you know, who were involved in things like ATD Fourth World, which is a human rights organization working with some of the poorest people, what is so important for them is to be treated with dignity, with respect, for recognition of them as human beings, dehumanized in the way that they're treated. And develop the notion that they're sort of being othered by every level, by politicians, by media, by academics, by officials and so forth, treated as other, as less than human. So all that has to be taken into account when we're developing our ideas around citizenship and democracy.
Which is always the thing that spurred me on with basic income, was it doesn't humiliate people, it does recognise them as citizens. Yeah. So I think it's a really nice tie in that. And since you've been in the House of Lords, you've done quite a lot of work on asylum and refugee rights. Do you want to just tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and I mean, it's something I've cared about for a while, but I hadn't worked on before. And it kind of dawned on me, it actually goes back to my upbringing. My father was a refugee from Nazi Germany. I mean, they got out early, they were lucky, they had money, they were able to get out. My mother was an internationalist and an ardent anti-racist. And I think that is a kind of heavily influenced sort of deep down that has kind of come back up. Now I've had the honour the House of Lords to work on these issues. So it's probably do as much work on that as I do on poverty and social security issues in the Lords. And there's an awful lot to be done. I mean, all the stuff around the hostile environment, masses of issues around asylum, detention issues, refugee issues. The two that I've probably particularly championed, one is something called the moving on period, which is when asylum seeker gets refugee status, which should be a time of happiness, rejoicing, security. They're only given 28 days to get onto the mainstream social security and housing. And you can't do it in 28 days usually. And their asylum support is stopped. Point when they're most vulnerable to destitution. I mean, it's so ridiculous. And I've got a private members bill on that, which was supposed to have its second reading next week, but of course it won't now. But I'm still going to, hopefully will come at some point. And then the other issue I'm really been championing is that of children who may have been born in this country or have lived in this country for most of their lives, but because of their parents' immigration status, they have to register their entitlement to citizenship. They do have that entitlement, but they have to register it. And it costs over £1,000 to do so. So, I mean, you know, many of them can't. So those are kind of issues that I'm sort of going to keep. And sometimes you kind of wonder what the hell you're doing there, but you know, at least the chance to try and push on issues like that that might otherwise get ignored.
Good. Well, as ever, more power to your over on all of that. Let's expand the conversation out even broader. At Compass, we have this concept of the good society, which you're always pushing me on to push to the fore of it. And you've got a big paper coming out for us in the next week or so on this. Why does this idea in particular kind of chime with you, and what does it mean for you?
Well, I think, I mean, it's partly it is. I think it's so important in our work. And it's partly that, I think it was Richard Titmuss many, many years ago who talked about how the social is always the handmaiden of the economic. And we, you know, obviously economies, the economic's important, but the economic should be the handmaiden of the social. And the idea of the good society helps us focus on the kind of society we want to live in, that we want to build together in a kind of holistic way, not just a sort of list of policies. And I think I see it as the sort of lodestar for Compass, kind of makes sense of all the rest of our work. And the paper that you mention, I mean, in that I argue, well, in a sense, it's very much a discussion paper. And I suggest that, you know, as well as the material building blocks for a good society of the distribution of money, of time, there are also other building blocks are ethical, things like ethic of care, cultural, democratic, environmental, internationalist, all these have to be put together and to kind of create a society in which we can live better together and live with ease, and people can fulfill themselves in the way that they want to. So I think it links the individual and the collective as well.
Well, that will be out hopefully next week. And I thought you said there are a list of policies, and I quite like the idea of a list of policies as opposed to a list of policies. So I'm looking forward to your list of policies for a good society. Now, you are a member of the Labour Party, and you're a member of Europe. You know, you take the Labour whip in the House of Lords, but you are one of the least tribal politicians that I know. What's it like being taking the whip and being a tribal loyalist in the House of Lords?
Well, it's probably easier when you're in opposition than when you're in power, and I've never been in the Lords in power, so I don't know. You can break the whip in opposition in a way that's a lot easier, I think. So I don't know what it would be like in power. But I wasn't born and bred Labour like many Labour politicians are, and I certainly never expected to end up in the House of Lords. And I think I'm not tribal, my politics really, I haven't really done my politics mainly through the Labour Party, I have to admit. And that part, again, I think probably goes back to my upbringing. My parents were both members of the Liberal Party, in fact, and if there wasn't a Liberal candidate, which was often the case, my mother voted Labour and my dad voted Tory, so certainly weren't very tribal in my household. And then university, I did try and join the Socialist Society, but they were so geeky and exclusive that I just get, you know, I was a rather timid pressure and I just never went back. So I didn't really get politically active till the 70s, and that was through the women's movement. And I was heavily involved in something called the Women's Liberation Campaign for Legal and Financial Independence. And that's that kind of thing about women's economic independence has been a really important element in a lot of the work I've done, both on poverty and citizenship, although tempered now by also greater understanding of our interdependence issues around care. And out of that campaign also came the Why Be a Wife campaign, which was highly successful, but rather short-lived. We just didn't have the woman power to keep it going. And then the 80s, I was so involved in CPAG. When I was director, it just completely took over my life and sort of anti-poverty politics. And I've never really sort of known where I fitted in the Labour Party. I suppose it'd be what people call the soft left, but I mean, it sounds so pathetic, doesn't it? It kind of sounds like, was it Lisa who said during her campaign, it sounds like a blancmange or something, you know? So then I discovered Comfort, because I think I was there at the founding meeting, and then, you know, Comfort has kind of provided me with political that I don't think a political party ever would.
And you know, tell us about your, because you were there at the very beginning. I can't remember where the meeting was, but there was a kind of, we got a group of kind of stakeholders together and you were in the room. I remember that. So tell us about kind of, you know, what you've enjoyed or what you've got out of being involved in Compass from the early 2000s.
Well, I mean, what attracted me to Compass is partly the fact it's not tribal, and of course got less so when we opened out beyond the Labour Party. I think partly very much the emphasis on how we do politics, you know, not just the kind, you know, the means being as important as the ends. And I think that really, really resonated with me. And it kind of links in with my sort of, the kind of my practice of mindfulness, really. And I'm writing something about that for Compass as well, separately. And the kind of idea around the good society. But also, I've called it, you know, my political home, and her political home is where you have comradeship and kind of in a sense, a political family. And so I think that's why I've kind of given, you know, as much energy as I have to Compass, and have been really, well, it's actually been a privilege to be on the board for all this, been too long, and certainly been chair of the board for too long, but it's been a privilege to be that, because it is such a great group of people that have kind of got together around Compass.
And you're gonna stay on the board after you step down as chair, aren't you, Ruth?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I hadn't intended to, but I'm kind of quite pleased to have been asked to, I have to admit.
Good. Fantastic stuff. Okay, Grace, should we begin to open it out to some other people now and find out what questions we've got? I haven't been looking, but you have. So why don't you call some other people in?
Yeah, we'll start with Margot Roberts, just because she was the first one to ask a question. So Margot asked, do you think Keir Starmer has been backward in coming forward around the subject of inequality and the way that it affects, the crisis is affecting people differently?
I don't think I want to pass judgment on Keir Starmer just yet. Give him a bit. I mean, he certainly talked about inequality and issues like that during his campaign, which was encouraging. I think it's such a difficult time to be taking over the party, and that's why I think I certainly want to cut him a bit of slack. I feel pretty confident that he will talk about these issues. He came and spoke to the Labour Peers Group last week, and obviously I can't say what he said, but I was quite encouraged by what he said there. But I think it's going to be important, those of us who are in the party, that we, you know, we put the pressure on to make sure he is getting that message across. And I think to begin with, and especially with Boris Johnson being in hospital and everything, you know, it was kind of, I think, very difficult to get any coherent message across. But particularly once Parliament's back, then the party has got to start saying things about differential impact of the virus and what further needs to be done. A lot, as I've said already, needs to be done to address that. And actually, on one, I don't agree with all the appointments he's made, but I was quite cheered to see that he'd, under the DWP brief, had got a slot for a child poverty strategy, which Labour hasn't had, I think, since 2010. And he gave it to Kate Green, who is one of my successors as director of CPAG. And that is a positive thing, I think. And I think actually Annalisa Dodds at the Treasury could be a very good news as well.
Go on, Grace, who's next?
All right, so we've got Simon Sapper, who has a question about the political appetite for investment.
Hi there, Grace. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. Well, Ruth, I was struck by your early comments about the care sector. I'm a low pay commissioner, and each year we go around the country talking to groups of low paid workers and their employers. We always see people from the care sector, and the problems of funding are systemic, endemic, intractable almost. So my question is, do you think that there really is the political appetite to come up with the solutions that would be needed to fund this sector properly? And if there isn't at the moment, how do we get to a stage where there is?
I don't know. I mean, we can't let the insights that have kind of developed during this crisis, you know, just disappear afterwards, because clearly prior to this crisis, there was absolutely no appetite whatsoever for investment of that kind. And social care is an absolute disgrace. I mean, and you'll know from going round talking to care workers. So I think you in your position and we all have got to keep up the pressure that they must, you know, lest we forget, really, is perhaps we should be. I mean, although I don't agree in, you know, treating this like the war, but lest we forget is perhaps rather good motto when it comes to care workers and the investment needed in social care. And what's happening in care homes at present, I mean, it's just makes you want to weep.
Grace?
Okay. So next up, we've got Andrea Wilson, who's got a question about key workers as well. So Andrea, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can.
Cool. Go for it.
I think actually you've started to answer it a little bit, Ruth, in that comment around keeping the insights that we're generating right now and the visibility, the less we forget. My question really was around how do you think we can actually keep the pressure on taking the positive experiences, not positive experiences, but how the public are feeling positive right now. So taking that energy and get a wider range of voices heard in the debate about how we reward key workers differently going forwards. It sort of feels like it's a moment that we could use better, but where would you start?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the way that we could encourage all those people who are volunteering today, who are getting together in their neighbourhoods. I don't know how we do that. I mean, you know, Compass is, you know, we're quite small, but we can work through our respective political parties, whichever they are, and we can bombard members of parliament, particularly Tory members of parliament, so that they know as soon as this crisis is over, and I don't know what over actually is going to mean, but their constituents are not going to forget. I mean, I think that might be the first, is to really put members of parliament, all parties, with very clear messages once we're through the worst of the crisis, but also encourage this kind of groundswell of volunteering and caring to think, you know, how can we build something out of this?
Yeah.
And there are some interesting ideas knocking around, kind of Royal College of Carers, as a way of kind of institutionalising what's going on and giving it esteem and position. Maybe in terms of the resources, Ruth, I mean, things like a wealth tax is now, you know, on the agenda, like basic income, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think certainly taxation, we've got to open the question about taxation and get away from this idea that taxation is a burden, but reconstitute the idea that it's the way we pay for decent services, decent benefits, and that it has, you know, we have people who have more, particularly more wealth, need to be paying more. And also, I mean, as well, there's also, you know, talk of a national care service. And I mean, people have been talking for ages about integrating the NHS and care service in some way. I mean, I'm not an expert on that, but in the kind of discussions, the endless, I mean, how long has it been going on that we've been waiting for a care strategy? We have to make, you know, they've got to come up with something, and we have to make sure that valuing the work of the carers who will be implementing that strategy is absolutely crucial.
All right. So for the next question, there's Roy, who has a pretty good question about Compass and what we've been doing since 2017, which I'm pretty sure Ruth will be able to answer in great detail.
So they'd rather that than the first question I asked.
Both questions will be really good, actually, Roy.
Okay, well, I'll start with the one about Compass. I've only just joined, and I really believe in the ideas. I really believe in cooperation and in all sorts of ways between progressive parties. But I'm just wondered how big Compass is, and whether I've joined something which is a bit of a minority, or whether it's, with the experience of the last two elections, there's a chance that it might actually be a growing movement. Shall I leave that and ask the other one in a minute?
Ruth, do you want to take that one now and then have the next one?
To Neil, actually. I mean, we can't claim to be a mass movement, but... And we've been going through, I mean, it's been quite a difficult period in a sense, I think, for Compass. And Neil might want to say more about that, because, you know, we weren't signed up to the Corbyn project, even though we weren't hostile to it. And so we were a bit perhaps marginalised in Labour Party politics for a while. And we took a line that we would be trying to get a debate going around the causes of Brexit and so forth, rather than come down and join, kind of add our weight, such as it was, to either side of the debate.
Yeah.
So, but we've been doing a lot of thinking during that time, and we've been doing quite a lot to make us a more robust organisation in terms of our governance, our membership, and we are ready to grow. And it's really great that you've joined us, Roy. I hope you won't give up on us just because you would like just yet. But these membership calls are all part of it, to make our members feel more involved than perhaps they have done in the past. And I think, you know, we've got big ideas, but not just on our own. I mean, I think the important thing is there are a lot of other progressive groups out there with, you know, working in parallel, and Neil does an awful lot of work trying to knit things together so that the whole is bigger than the different parts. So you might not always see Compass's name on something, but it doesn't mean we're not working behind the scenes helping to promote some of the ideas. But Neil, I don't know if you want to add to that.
No, that was pretty perfect, really. It's been a difficult time. We're coming out of that difficult time. And our strength, Roy, and other members, is partly, you know, in you, our members, and partly, you know, the board. But we have a fantastic network of people and organisations. Mm-hmm. We've built up trust and relationships across the parties, across the think tanks, across all sorts of progressive organisations, in the media and academia. We're kind of like, you know, super connectors in the world of politics and new politics and political change. So that's our strength. And I think this moment of flux is one in which we can apply our thinking, the kind of the culture of our politics, but also big ideas like 45 degree change, pushing big policy stuff like basic income, Green New Deal, Citizens Convention to rewrite our democracy. This is a moment for Compass to really kind of expand and have an impact on the national political debate. So we're glad you're with us.
Yeah, okay. Do you want the other one, Grace?
Go for it. Yeah.
Can I just say to that, I think a discussion, it would be good I feel it would be good to know exactly what things, what aspects we can be pushing with people we come into contact with in whatever party we're in or whatever group we're in. Because people don't change their minds immediately, do they? They take a long time, and sometimes we have to sow seeds, and maybe we see that people actually change within a year, 2 years, 3 years. Something happens that makes them think, oh yeah, that's a good idea. So I think if we could have an idea of what things we agree collectively we should be pushing, then it would be good to have those in the back of our minds and pushing them whenever we get the opportunity. The other thing I wanted to ask about was universal basic income. I think it sounds like a really good idea, but I don't really understand the detail as to what it would replace, or whether it would replace anything, or whether it would be something on top of it, anything else people get. And on top of that, I think the risk about it is it like all universal benefits, it's open to ridicule from the right, in that people say, well, what do millionaires want universal basic income for? And I wonder whether it might be more palatable in terms of the broader political scene if it were just, or rather if there was some sort of take back above a certain income level whereby people's tax allowance or tax code was adjusted so that in effect they're paying back, or they're not getting the benefit of universal of the UBI.
On UBI, just there are sort of two kind of broad models, Roy. I mean, one is what's called partial UBI, and that's what I was talking about, and I think it's being what's being promoted at present as a kind of emergency measure, and that wouldn't replace anything. It would act as a floor underneath the existing system, so it would kind of fill in the gaps, probably quite modestly, but it would be something. Some people do talk about a fully fledged UBI that would replace existing benefits, and then it becomes a lot more tricky because, as I said, there are things like, you know, disability benefits which have to meet various disability costs, which UBI isn't so well placed to do. There are housing costs which are very variable and things like that. So that's why I think it's better to start modest. One proposal that actually was put forward in a Compass report was that you could largely pay for it by doing away with personal tax allowances, which are pretty regressive, actually. Enormous amount of money has been put into personal tax allowances in recent years, particularly under the coalition government, promoted as being helping the low paid, actually not really helping, and each time helping them less and less because fewer and fewer are paying tax. Certainly not helping lower paid women. I'm a universalist. I do believe that, but what I agree is that you then use the tax system, not necessarily directly, because actually they're trying to do that with child benefit, and it actually just made it a real mess and complicated what was a very simple scheme, was the high income charge on child benefit. But yes, you'd have to have a much more progressive tax system. The good thing about universalism is that there are no cracks for people to fall through. I mean, there are questions about, you know, who gets it in terms of, and I think still have got to be resolved by people who are, you know, really doing the work on UBI in terms of, you know, residence, citizenship and so forth. But that aside, it does provide that genuine security that people know it will be there. And that, you know, for say a woman who has to leave because of domestic violence, that can make an enormous difference.
All right. The next question comes from Marjorie Drake, and it's about pensions. Hopefully. Marjorie, can you hear us?
Yes.
Brilliant.
I've been reading today about the state pension and how there's been a suggestion that we should abolish the triple lock on pensions, which has been in place for about 10 years, I think. And I'm aware, as a pensioner, that my income has been protected all that time, and I've felt quite guilty when I've seen how wages have gone down. And I wonder what you think about that, Ruth.
Well, I mean, I'm a pensioner as well, Marjorie. I don't think you should feel guilty, But I've actually have argued in the past that in fact, when I was doing wrote something about the not just the Labour Party manifesto that's gone, but the one before that, that actually we shouldn't be committing ourselves to the triple lock. Not so much because of the comparison with wages, but the comparison with working age benefits, which have been frozen for 4 years. I mean, while pensions have been protected, I'm not arguing against pension protection, working age benefits have gone down in value significantly, and contributing to a big increase in inequality before even, you know, the impact of the current crisis. So I would go back to, and I think this is what's actually being argued for in, I think it's the Social Market Foundation that's come out with a report today. What used to be the case, which is like a double lock, you know, it goes up with earnings or prices, whichever is the greater. And I seem to remember, but I've forgotten now the details, there's a more sort of sophisticated way of doing that, that you would at least make, you wouldn't allow the real value of the pension to decline. And then you have greater equity between those of working age who are actually now at greater risk of poverty. And children are at much greater risk of poverty than our pensioners.
Yeah.
And the risk of poverty among pensioners has gone down significantly, which is a good thing, the great thing. But I think we do need to look again at the triple lock.
Thank you.
Okay, so probably the last question we'll have time for from Sarah Perrigo. Sarah, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Hi Ruth.
Hi Sarah.
I've got this obsession because as a political theorist, I've always been interested in the bankruptcy of our political system and its institutions. And under Corbyn, there was this promise for a constitutional convention. I'm just wondering whether you think that we might progress as a whole constitutional convention and some kind of real discussion about devolution, regionalism, PR, and all those things are likely to happen under Corbyn, under Keir
Starmer. I hope so. And I think he's talked about it during his election campaign, and he is, I think, the first leader we've had who has come out in favour of PR, which has to be a bonus. And I think there's be quite a lot of pressure on him to set something up quite now. And I think it would be a good, you know, it would be a good thing for him to set up something, some kind of, I don't know what, to do the work on constitutional convention. And I think all the, you know, the kind of work that's been going on around citizens' assemblies recently will help as well. So I'm quietly optimistic that something may come of this. But again, you know, it would be really important that Labour Party members put the pressure on to, because, you know, there are some people in the party, it's just kind of, who cares about that stuff? You know, it doesn't, no one cares on the doorstep about it sort of thing. So it is important that individual members of the party show that, you know, we care, they care, and want something to happen.
Good.
Yep.
And that link between, you know, if we want that good society, we're going to have a good politics to get there. And, you know, that's the focus of Compass's activity. How do we change the democratic and political system so that people can make the choices to get that good society, which is why we've been pushing so hard on PR, constitutional conventions around Brexit, and now hopefully in and around the Labour Party. And there may be things emerging on that. So, Ruth, let's end with one final question, which I ask most people. You know, in these kind of difficult and challenging times, you know, where do you see hope coming from? What, you know, what gets you out of bed and keeps you going and driving towards that endless journey to a good society? You know, where's hope for you?
Well, I think at present, I'd say there are two main sources of hope. One is just the sheer decency and the kindness that is being shown by people throughout the country at present, be it organised or be it or in local WhatsApp groups that are springing up all over the place to make sure that no one in someone's neighbourhood is isolated. And the unbelievable response to the request for volunteers. I mean, apparently the government completely bowled over by the response of the numbers of people signing up for this, you know, new volunteer service. So that there are so many people who want to give to society has to be a source of hope. And I think my other source of hope is just a number of commentaries I've read from across the political spectrum saying, when this is over, we can't go back to how things were before. We have to, as Barry Knight put it in his recent Compass publication, we have to build back better. And of course, you know, people say, well, you know, what about 2008? We said that then and look what happened. And of course, that's true. And I'm quite sure that as we speak, there is some right-wing think tank who is, you know, beavering away on, you know, austerity mark two and, you know, how to put, you know, our nation first and make immigration rules even tougher than they are and all that. And yes, of course, we can't be naive that that's, you know, what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism isn't kind of, you know, organizing again. But I don't know about the rest of you. I just feel something different is happening this time, that this goes much deeper in terms of how people see themselves, how they see themselves in relation to fellow citizens, how they see themselves in the world. And I think it would be harder to for a repeat of what happened in 2008. I mean, with, you know, going back to where we started, that so much has been revealed about consequences of 10 years of austerity in terms of the dismal state of our services, the NHS, care services, social services, the inadequacy of our benefits. You know, people are saying, well, how can I live on statutory sick pay of 90 odd pounds? Not realizing that many people are living on universal credit, which is less than that. And I think as more, so many people will be confronted with the realities of our, some of our services and our benefits, that I hope that they won't just, you know, when they things go back to whatever normal is, forget that. So that could be a kind of great reservoir of support for kind of policies that some of us have been arguing for years. And as I say, you know, we talked about in terms of care workers and so forth, NHS workers, it's difficult to believe that it would be that the government can simply put that to one side and say, well, we're, you know, we're going to carry on, you know, paying them like we did, and we're going to carry on with our sort of proposed immigration policies and so forth. I mean, I may be wrong, of course, but I just feel, I think there's something very fundamental going on in terms of the questions that are being asked about the kind of society in which we live, and more fundamental than was after 2008. So that gives me hope, and it gives me hope that there are groups like Compass, that a lot of work's already been done, you know, around Green New Deal, around just transition, around you know, constitutional reform, good society, all that, that's there, that can be knitted together. Hopefully that, you know, we can really try and command we can really influence the debate that happens coming out of this terrible, terrible time.
Okay, Ruth, let's get our knitting needles out and let's kind of make sure that we knit all of that together. Let's beaver away harder, better, more generously and ambitiously than any of the right-wing think tanks. And let's kind of command that agenda in the nicest possible way. It's been great talking to you and hearing from you. It's great, all the contributions and the discussion. Thanks, everyone, for joining us tonight. It's your membership which makes our organisation happen and makes it possible for us to do these conversations, publish our work, campaign on all the things we do. If anyone's listening and wants to know more about creating a more equal, democratic and sustainable future, a good society, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard tonight, please give us a rating on your podcast system so that more people will listen to us in the future. So look out for details of next week's speaker. We'll be announcing that soon. Again, thank you so much, Ruth. Thank you, Grace, for your help. Until next week, please, everyone, keep safe, keep well, and keep beavering away. Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.